Welcome to Big Ideas, Paul Barclay with you here on RN and online at abc.net.au/radio national. Now, imagine if you can that you're a young Australian traveller visiting Bulgaria. You're out with some friends in the capital, Sofia, you've had a few drinks, and you're wandering across town when you notice a gypsy being attacked by a gang of soccer hooligans. You rush over to help him, but the gang turn their attack on you, forcing you to defend yourself with a knife. Within minutes, you've killed someone and injured another. This is the story of Jock Palfreyman, and it may ring a bell for some of you. The description I've just given is Jock's version of what happened that fateful night in 2007, and it's highly contested. In fact, it was rejected by the Bulgarian courts, who concluded the Australian was a vicious, premeditated murderer. He's now incarcerated in a Bulgarian prison where he's likely to stay for a long time to come. Belinda Hawkins was drawn to this story as a journalist working for ABC TV's Australian Story, covering the tireless efforts of Jock's father, Simon, as he fights for justice for his son. But she never forgets that on the other side of the world, two parents are mourning the death of their young son, Andrei Monov, someone who had his whole life ahead of him. Belinda Hawkins has produced several TV reports on this story. She's been to Bulgaria 7 times and has written a book entitled Every Parent's Nightmare. Why was Jock Palfreyman carrying a large knife with him that night? Did he receive a fair trial? How much can we trust the Bulgarian justice system? And why do Bulgarians, especially their media, reject out of hand Jock's side of the story? These are just some of the questions that continue to linger. She spoke with me at Avid Reader in Brisbane, and I was curious to know if she was first attracted to the story because she thought a miscarriage of justice had occurred.
Not at that point, not at all. No, I entered the whole beginnings of making phone calls thinking this is probably some ratbag teenage kid who deserves to be put away, but I do feel for his parents. And, as you suggested, I felt very strongly, empathetically, for the parents of the young man who died, a 20-year-old law student called Andrei Monov. Both sets of parents were middle-class professionals. The Bulgarian mother is a lawyer, the father is a psychologist, and on the Australian side, the father is a pathologist trained as a doctor, and the mother is a dentist. So they came from similar backgrounds in that sense, but from very different parts of the world. Yeah. Both were obviously going to be fighting for justice for their child. Both were grieving, in a sense. Both were out of their depth. Both sets of parents were out of their depth. And that, to me, meant whatever Jock Palfreyman was, whatever had happened that night, it's a murder mystery, that's going to be interesting, but no matter who he was, whether he was guilty or innocent, this was going to be a very human story. And, of course, that's what all Australian stories are.
Yes. Did Simon Palfreyman want you to write this book?
The book was never raised in the start, so this came up much later. After 4 years or 3.5 years of following it, Simon had come to know me and Jock had come to know me, so there was a level of trust there. Yeah. But to begin with, Simon wouldn't speak to me on the phone. Then he only spoke hesitantly. It took months before he would agree to see me. And a Brisbane Australian Story crew and I went to Newcastle and met he and his wife. And then he was absolutely terror-struck. He'd never been public, so that was a nerve-wracking thing in itself. But he was also anxious not to offend the Bulgarian court, even though by that stage he had seen 5 months of spasmodic hearings held once every 2 weeks or 3 weeks or sometimes over consecutive days. And he was starting to become very concerned about what he saw in court, but he didn't want to upset anybody. So for that reason, he was terribly nervous about speaking to me. Added to that, he had seen what I now consider to be appalling reporting of the case by many Bulgaria media outlets and by some Australian media outlets.
We'll come to that. So by the time you made the decision to write this book, you're fully immersed in the story, you know much of the detail about it. What is your role as the author of this book? Are you the objective journalist? Are you the investigative journalist attempting to right a grave wrong? What are your motivations when you decide to write this book?
I had to address that in every telephone call my Bulgarian researcher, Boryana Tsambazova, and I made to the prosecutor, to the judges, to witnesses on all sides, as well as, of course, to Jock Polfreman in particular. Simon Polfreman understood after 3 years of me dipping in and out of the story in between doing other pieces. He understood that while I had come to know him, I was always going to be an outsider, and there was every chance I might find his son had done something that he didn't believe his son had done. Mm. Jock had a lot of reservations about me writing a book and voiced them to his father, voiced them very energetically to me. His sense was that a young person is an evolving person, and that in 10 years' time he would still hold the same values, but he could be a very different fellow, and that to be pinned down like an insect on a board could be an uncomfortable thing, and I don't think he welcomed that. However, when I was clearly going to go ahead with it, he agreed to continue having more and more interviews with me and to go over some areas that I wasn't certain of, where I wanted to be in his voice.
You had an open mind then about where the story was going to take you?
At that time, and for all the way until the very last moment of my research, I prevaricated between was he guilty as charged, or was there a terrible miscarriage of justice taking place here? And it was only in that very last moment, when I got access to CCTV footage, that my point of view changed altogether.
Mm. Now, let's get a sense, because much of this story is disputed, let's get a sense of what the agreed facts of the evening were when the stabbings took place. What do both parties agree actually took place in that square in Sofia?
Both parties say that on the night of the 27th of December 2007, a group of young Bulgarians had been out drinking and had been out carousing, if you like, with each other. And the Australian had been out in a bar drinking with two British friends and had met up with a young Bulgarian. They met each other, if you like, in a downtown city square by chance. And that's where an altercation happened. Jock never disputed that he held a pocket knife, a large pocket knife, a butterfly knife, in his pocket. He had it in his pocket that night. And he said that he had gone to help a gypsy who was being attacked, one in particular, but there had been two originally. Mm. It was never disputed that at the end of a fracas of some sort, a 20-year-old Bulgarian, Andrei Monov, sustained a single stab wound and died, and another one, a 19-year-old, had a small nick wound, a knife nick wound. Mm. Later, many aspects of was Jock injured, wasn't he injured, the degree to which the boy with a slash wound was injured, the degree to which he was injured, all of those things became heavily disputed. Mm. But, of course, it was accepted that someone had died, bottom line.
Fundamental aspects of this case become disputed. For example, there is some dispute about whether gypsies were even present, whether there was one, whether there was two, whether Jock really was coming to the aid of them, as he said. Do you believe, and is it now clear, that this is a plausible explanation, that there were gypsies under attack?
When I got to see this CCTV footage that was collected that night, it has to be remembered that there was CCTV footage outside the building, the government building where Jock was arrested, that was in full sight of the melee, the final part of the melee. That disappeared, but there was traffic recordings that were kept. When I finally got access to that traffic recording, I could see that indeed two of Andrei Monov's group followed a young man who could, or a figure who could well be a gypsy, and then lunged at him, and then started to chase he and another young man who could well be a gypsy. And then, as though a clarion call had gone out, some 15 young men rushed across the square in pursuit of that fellow. And then, about 30 or 40 seconds later, you see a shadowy figure go across the back of the square, and that figure can only be Jock Polfreman. Mm. So that is in no doubt. Were those two figures initially lunged at and chased, were they gypsies? You can't tell.
They're the crucial people in this story, and they're the people that never get to put their evidence to court. They're the people who could exonerate Jock tomorrow if their evidence corresponded with his. Was any real effort made to attempt to find these individuals?
At least one police officer at the scene in the early hours of the 28th of December, when the group was still there, one police officer at least talked to a number of Andre Monoff's friends who said, "We had an altercation with a gypsy and the foreigner intervened." And then the altercation escalated. Mm. So that night it was known there was a gypsy. As the boys, the young men, came in to give police statements, a number of them talked about having an altercation with someone who could have been a gypsy and talked about having an altercation with someone who was a gypsy. So in that sense, police were under no doubt there was a gypsy there. The kiosk owner, there was a 24-hour kiosk in the square. The kiosk owner, at the moment when the whole group, just before the whole group rushed across the square, heard this derogatory term get screamed out, "Mungo," a derogatory term for a gypsy. In that sense, there was also evidence there was a gypsy, but police that night made, it seems, no attempt to locate the gypsy, and nor did the police investigator or the prosecutor try to find the gypsy in the ensuing days. Indeed, far from it. As the days went by, it was as though there was an attempt to whitewash over any altercation, any mention of altercation, and certainly any mention of a gypsy. More than that, many witnesses talked about Andre Monoff and his friends chanting football slogans and being a group of football fans. Mm. It wasn't the time of the year when they had been coming from a football match, but nonetheless that they were drawn together with a love of football. But as the days went by, and certainly once it got to court, they were not football fans anymore, according to them. That got washed away as well.
Because being a football fan is code for something else. Is being a football fan code for being a far-right nationalist Bulgarian? And in turn, we know that far-right nationalists have in the past in Bulgaria assaulted gypsies. This is not uncommon in that country.
It's not uncommon. Gypsies are reviled. Wherever I went in that country, even when I went and met Jock's Bulgarian friends who lived in a town outside the capital city, they all said to me, "We all hate gypsies." We used to argue with Jock, who lived with them for some 5 months, had a girlfriend among them and so forth. They all said, "We all hate gypsies." Everybody I met, except my researcher pretty well, hated gypsies. Mm. So I've no doubt that they're a reviled minority group, and there's a lot of evidence of that put forward by human rights groups. I think it's unfair to say that all soccer fans or football fans are right-wing extremists, and I argued relentlessly with Jock that to call them neo-Nazis, to call them even football hooligans, was a dangerous and an unfounded thing. Mm. Were they right-wing extremists? They could well have been. Mm. Were they football hooligans? They could well have been. But there is no factual basis to that.
Why did almost all of Bulgaria and almost all of the media instantly take a dislike to Jock, instantly not believe his story, and pretty much instantly turn against him and turn the Bulgarian public against him?
What happened that night when he was, or that early morning when he was arrested, I think could have happened in many respects, could have happened in any city here in Australia. Police got to the scene. There was a man on the ground with people still hurling things at him, and it looked like the group around him wanted to lynch him, and a knife on the ground, a bloodied knife on the ground some distance from him, and him saying, putting his hands up, virtually saying, you know, "Help me, help me." They figured, we've got the killer, we've got the victim, job's done. And I think there was a presumption that the foreigner had done it and the poor Bulgarian student was the unfortunate victim. Then it went into overdrive, though, and some of the police investigators were telling police, the Bulgarian fellow, our boy, was stabbed in the back. Immediately that sent out, the stabbed in the back is still an incorrect factual detail put around this case. So this fellow, Jock Palfreyman, became this madman. They were sure he was on drugs or drunk, that he'd stabbed the fellow in the back, that he'd done it in a frenzied fashion. And as the police gave more and more information out to the media, the stories became increasingly hyperbolic until he was the butcher who came to that country with the sole desire to take out as many young Bulgarians as possible and in an absolutely indiscriminate manner. Mm. Now, I think that we've seen media hyperbole like that in cases in Australia. Mm. And the Lindy Chamberlain case is a very good example. Mm. In Bulgaria, my sense was that he was a foreigner, he was other, he had a strange haircut, he had an army, he was in the army at that point. He had an army crew cut, which, as almost a joke, he had cut even shorter so that one little thread of it was a bit like a mohawk, only it's a, you know, a rise of only several centimetres, so you'd hardly call it a mohawk, but that was an unusual haircut.
It's a bad look.
It was a bad look, yeah. And the knife he carried that he scooped up in the last moment, as he says, in a country where knives are commonplace and where it's not illegal to carry knives, and this knife I saw across the country, the knife is an ugly knife. It's a butterfly knife. It's a nasty-looking knife.
It is. There's a photograph of it in the book, a nasty, long, very, very ugly-looking knife. Before we go into the detail of the trial, there's a lot of legal detail in the book, very important that we talk about how the trial was conducted. It's one of the most interesting and disturbing parts of the book. But before we do, I just wouldn't mind getting your sense of this guy, Jock Paul Freeman. What type of person is he? He comes across in the book as quite a complex character. He's certainly a young man, and, you know, we all have muddled views and we're sometimes impetuous when we're young. He's not always a sympathetic character, though, the way you portray him, at least, in the book.
To my mind, as you read the book, you'll come to have different impressions of Jock, and that's probably what I did over the years that I've seen him and spoken to him. I don't think it's important whether you decide you like him or not. I don't think it's important whether you decide you like the father of the dead boy or not. Ultimately, what's important was, what do you think happened, and do you think justice was served? So I hope that a reader makes their own opinion on all of those things. For me, what did I think of Jock Palfreman? I think he, when I first met him, he was 21, going on 22. He's a very young man at that point. He's full of energy. He's like a, you know, like a, yeah, a ball of energy, trapped in a cage, obviously, with an enormous general knowledge, a love of talking to people about whatever that person's interested in, loves arguing about history, argued with me about every point of politics, every point of history, argued perpetually with his equally well-educated father about all matter of things, to the point where, you know, his father would roll his eyes but continue to engage. So that, my understanding from Jock's friends with whom he was at school, is how Jock's always been. I think he had many like-minded friends at school who were equally intrigued by the world of politics and international events and engaged with it. I think that Jock, from an early age, had a strong social conscience. He went to a school in Sydney with a shorthand name called Riverview, and my understanding, I'm not from Sydney, but my understanding, Jesuit school, that's right. I'm an Argentine, so, you know, I'm barracking for the new Pope in that sense, but that's about as far as my sense of Catholicism goes. But I do understand from those who have been to the school and have been around that school that there is a social justice sensibility that the young boys grow up with as they go through that school, and that chimed with the boy Jock already was, and I think the school probably developed it in him, as it did in a number of his friends.
Well, you see, here's the paradox. That sense of social justice is what leads him to jump to the assistance of the gypsies in the square that are being attacked. Yet at the same time as he's jumping to their assistance, he has in his pocket a 13.5-centimetre butterfly knife.
And 12.3.
12.3, was it? Okay. Centimetre shorter than I thought.
It's a big pocket knife.
It's a big pocket knife. Now, the average Australian backpacker does not walk around European cities with a big knife in their pocket. He says that he carried the knife for protection because he had been attacked before in Bulgaria. His mother-in-law, interestingly, still finds it hard, according to your book, to accept the fact
that... His stepmother.
What do you think? Do you accept his reasoning for carrying a knife in public?
His father and his stepmother, who were the family members most often were always at court, and the ones who've seen him most often, and they very much grappled with that to begin with. His father, when he heard that he'd had a knife in his pocket, his whole heart sunk. You know, why would they draw a knife out of their pocket? I mean, they might have a pocket knife, but why would they bring it out? In this country, to do that is illegal. In the UK, it's illegal. In Bulgaria, it's not illegal, just bearing that in mind. Mm. Nonetheless, they grappled with that, and his stepmother, for all her love of Jock and so forth, she continued to grapple with that. I continue to grapple with it also. However, I have, what you have to do in a story like this is you have to step inside the shoes of all the different players in this tragedy. And so as I tried to step inside Jock's shoes, I've come to understand from speaking to his friends, did he always carry a pocket knife in Bulgaria? No, that was an unusual thing. Did he carry some form of self-protection? After he had seen a lot of particularly knife violence, he'd started to carry a spray. He says he tried to buy it when he returned to Bulgaria for this ill-fated Christmas holiday and hadn't been able to find it, and that it was a snap decision as he ran back in the house to grab his ID, and the knife was there, his mate's knife, not his. It was sitting there next to his ID, and I've seen it in a photo. It's just eerie to see it in a photo. He scooped the two things up in the one movement and put it in his pocket. I can only, you have to suspend disbelief. I have to just believe that there's no reason that didn't happen. There's no reason to disbelieve his friends that he did not normally carry a pocket knife. Then it comes to, why did he pull it out? What possessed a person to pull a knife out? So I try to step into his shoes. I do remember when I was 21, living in student housing in Fitzroy in Melbourne, for one incredibly insane period where we'd been broken into, and I was nervous about being broken into. We were three women living together. For a while, I took a kitchen knife that was, in the old term, about a foot long. It was the most massive knife, and I kept it under my bed, and I felt hideously safe for night after night after night, until one morning I woke up, a far smarter person, and thought, if, God forbid, someone came and attacked me and I pulled that knife out, and I'm lying in bed, quick as a flash, they'll turn it on me and I'll be, I'll be impaled on this thing in an instant. But I did have the thought that it would have terrified someone away for a short while. Jock, I think, had what I believe, and he argues with me continuously, what I believe was a very misguided sense that when he says the group, and so do some independent witnesses, when he says the group turned from attacking the gypsy on the ground, turned and started to attack him, who was trying to push them away, he pulled the knife out and raised it in the air, as an independent witness says he did, and he did so thinking that would frighten the group away, would frighten the young men away. But let's remember that the young man who died had a blood alcohol content, it was later ascertained, of 0.29. So he's almost six times the legal driving limit. The young man who was injured had a blood alcohol content of 0.18, almost four times the legal driving limit. Nobody else except the dead man, the injured man, and Jock, who had also sustained an injury, were blood tested. Jock's reading was 0.1, so he's double the driving limit. Nobody else was tested, but it's fair to assume that there were many others who were drunk, perhaps not so staggeringly drunk as Andrei Monov was. Alcohol played a part in that. And I travelled to the north of Scotland to visit a forensic scientist, and he just shook his head and said, with a very rich Scottish accent, which I cannot begin to imitate, he said, it's absolutely the case that drunk young men will run towards the weapon and say, stuff you, you are not going to frighten us away, so you will bring the attack on even further and more ferociously. And I believe that's what happened.
Belinda Hawkins, journalist with ABC TV's Australian Story and author of Every Parent's Nightmare, talking with me at Avid Reader about the story of Jock Palfreyman, the young Australian in prison in Bulgaria for a crime he says he didn't commit. You're with Big Ideas on RN or at abc.net. sbs.com.au/radionational. I'm Paul Barclay. To download a podcast of this discussion, head to our website or to iTunes. For now, we'll head back to Avid Reader. Let's go to the trial. What is Jock charged with?
Jock was charged with one of the worst counts of murder in Bulgaria. It's a bizarre charge. It's murder with hooliganism. The term hooliganism and that charge comes from the old Soviet days. Let's remember that Bulgaria was a communist state for some 45 years, and Mother Russia was the great benefactor and friend of Bulgaria there, and their legal system, a hybrid of the Stalinist system, hybrid with the French inquisitorial system, contained a mishmash of things. And hooliganism, the charge of hooliganism came from those Soviet times. So he's charged with murder with hooliganism and attempted murder.
Premeditated murder.
Murder with hooliganism means it's premeditated. It means there was that he was unprovoked, and it means more than that. It means he had no other motive other than to wreak complete havoc on as many people and as much of the society he's wreaking havoc on, in this case Bulgaria, as possible.
His defence is self-defence?
His defence was self-defence. He also, his defence was self-defence.
In Australia, self-defence is an absolute defence. If that defence is accepted here in a criminal case, then you can be completely acquitted. Is that also the case in Bulgaria?
It's also the case in Bulgaria.
One of the many, actually, disturbing features of the trial is that countless witnesses, including members of the group at the square, friends of Andrei's, give contradictory accounts of what occurred that night. They change their evidence from what they said earlier to what they say in court. Yet, regardless of this, their version of events seems to be accepted. Their modified, changed version of events, convenient version of events, seems to be accepted by the court. This is very significant in terms of Jock's chances of success in the trial, isn't it?
It was enormously, it had a huge impact. I mean, it had an impact even before the matter went to trial. So even before they changed their statements, the prosecutor painted a picture of what happened that night, and that's what a prosecutor's meant to do, pulling pieces of witness statements together, but never said there was a gypsy, and claimed that the attack happened, that the whole thing started at these traffic lights. The prosecutor, a woman called Pavleta Nikova, said nothing about that there had been this almighty chasing of a person across the square, and that some of the altercation, if you like, had happened on the very other side. So in the public mind, and certainly the picture she painted, was that these boys had been at the traffic lights and Jock had just run at them at the traffic lights, you know, and startled them and started stabbing them willy-nilly. And that's the version that went all through the trial. And so when it came to the trial, the young men just said, no, there was no gypsy. No, we weren't a group, a cohesive group in any sense. We weren't football fans in any sense.
In spite of the fact that one of them had said earlier that there was actually a gypsy present.
They were able, because of a law put in place in Bulgaria, perversely in this situation, designed to protect defendants, because of a law in place at that stage, they were allowed to give contradictory evidence, and the defence couldn't contest it. They tried to contest it. This is another strange aspect to this case, and it's not so strange to Europe. So we must be so careful never to criticise the way the trial ran by comparing it to how our trials would win.
Except that this is a fundamental change in what they've said. At one point they're saying there's a gypsy, which is the critical part of Jock's defence, and then in court they're saying no, there wasn't. And it just so happens that that change of evidence is extremely convenient to the prosecution's case.
And each time the defence would say, oh, excuse me, but can we please just read out the bit of your original witness statement where you said there was a gypsy, there was an altercation of some description. And immediately the civil claimants who were able to run their compensation claim concurrent with the criminal proceeding.
Yeah, another extraordinary part of the trial.
That was an extraordinary thing. The civil claimants, so they are the victims, and in this situation they were the parents of the dead young man and the injured young man. The civil claimants could put their hands up or through their lawyers say, no, we dispute that, we do not want that bit of witness statement read aloud or entered in as evidence. And the prosecutor could say, no, I do not want that. I don't want that read aloud. I don't want that included as part of the hearing. And with two against one, they won every time. So each time the defence would say, oh, excuse me, but can we please look at witness statement 360? The prosecution and the civil claimants joined and objected, and that was okay.
I mean, what strikes me as being completely bizarre about this is, of course, these people had a vested interest in their witness statements. The objective witnesses, people who had no real vested interest other than telling the court what they actually saw, many of these people's versions of events coincided with Jock's. Yet the more objective witnesses didn't seem to be taken notice of as much as these other witnesses. How do we explain this?
People who are well-versed in understanding many European jurisdictions will explain to you, Paul, that in many court cases, having the judge as the investigator, which is what the inquisitorial system does, rather than having two sides arguing it out with each other, which is what our adversarial system does, that having the judge as the ultimate investigator, hearing absolutely everything that can be heard and pulling all the evidence together, having anything that's ever been written in front of him or her, that can work as a very successful system, and he or she brings their expertise and their dispassionate, unbiased sensibility to it, and they come up with the correct answer. And that it's...
I've heard that argument.
That it's been going for, you know, countless numbers of years, and it works very effectively in many jurisdictions. In this situation, you can argue there's doubt whether it worked.
There's no jury. We haven't pointed that out either, is there?
There's not a jury of ordinary citizens in the way that we understand. In Bulgaria, as in many European jurisdictions, there is a panel of what are variously called lay jurors, professional jurors or lay judges. So they are people generally with a legal background, and they're often mostly retired, and they have their names on a list, and they're assigned as a panel of three of them, and they take part in the decision-making about guilt or innocence.
These are the wise men, are they?
Well, wise men and women.
Wise men and women.
That's right. And in this situation, of course, one of the lay jurors or professional jurors or lay judges, anyway, one of those three, failed to turn up a couple of times. I mean, I have to say, it was a chaotically run trial.
There are so many aspects. We're not going to be able to cover all of them. There's the forensic doctor responsible for compiling the forensic report, who was charged with, can you believe it, the illegal sale of body parts on the, organ sales, bizarre aspect of the story. But then there is the fact, significantly, that the victim's family is very well connected within the Sophia legal fraternity. Jock believes, and his father Simon perhaps later comes to this belief, that the trial and the legal process was corrupted. I use that term loosely. Do you see any association between the victim's family and some dubious, arguably dubious aspects of this trial?
In writing this book, I have been, I hope, painstakingly careful to lay out what the facts were as I found in documentary evidence and in CCTV footage and also in running interviews with people. If I couldn't find absolute categoric proof of corruption, for example, and a person wasn't charged with corruption, then I'm not going to say in any sense that they're corrupt. Paul, I think that in any community, particularly a small community, Bulgaria has a population of 7 million. It's a small country. If we were to look at the community of Melbourne, of Sydney, of Brisbane, if you have a small community, influence matters. Who you know matters. It doesn't matter where you are in the world. That's going to count. Bulgarian human rights organisations tell me, and so too did many lawyers in Bulgaria, tell me that this matters even more so in Bulgaria, possibly because of the communist past that it had, possibly from the difficult transition to a capitalist economy, possibly for all sorts of reasons, and because it's an even smaller society, that influence matters even more, that corridor conversations are what dictate what happens, what goes on in courts and so forth. But you cannot prove that. I can say categorically that at the funeral of Andrei Monov, there was the head of the highest court in Bulgaria. He's a friend of the Monovs. Mm. There was the government minister who within months would become the interior minister, so in charge of police. There were many other government ministers. It was a government then, the party that was in power then was the Socialist Party. And this comes to a very interesting point if we bring the story up to what's happening now in Bulgaria. So the Socialists were in power. Later, they were voted out and a different party came in, a party called GERB, a more right-wing party. Now, over the past month, Bulgarians have gone to the streets in what's said to be unprecedented numbers, protesting about the massive cost of living, dire poverty and corruption. Corruption is a word which I am loath to use, but which comes up over and over again, particularly in relation to the justice system and in relation to police. So they took to the streets, they had these massive protests, police unleashed this extraordinary amount of violence on the protests at one point, and that point, finally, the Prime Minister, who is himself under criticism and himself being accused of particularly heinous things, said, right, I'm resigning, my whole government's resigning. And at the moment, there's a caretaker government, and there's an election in May. A few days ago, the father of the dead boy, the father is called Christo, the son is Andrei Monov, Christo Monov, it was announced that he is running for the Socialist Party in the upcoming election on the other side of the country from where he lives, in a safe seat.
Well, he's an interesting character because he had a profile before this incident even occurred, a media profile, and he very much used that profile after his son was killed to paint a picture, a very specific picture of Jock as being essentially a sociopathic murderer, and repeated the allegation pretty much over and over.
Well, he calls him a sociopath on many occasions. Now, Christo Monov, to me, was a fascinating character. The parents of the dead young man and what they went through, I both sympathised with it and I was intrigued by it. What happens when you go through that kind of grief? When your child, it's often pointed out it was their only child, but for me, for my money, any child, if your child dies, what do you go through? What, and if your child dies in this sort of situation where there's the accusation of murder, how do you cope with it? How do you reconcile the death of your child and your feelings towards the accused? And we've seen it in so many cases in Australia where the grieving parents, if presented with someone as the accused, the grieving parents decide that is the person, no matter what happens in court, no matter whether black is white or white is black, you know, in the wash-up in court, the person who is put to them as the guilty party becomes the guilty party and will always be the guilty party. And there's a dreadful case that we covered in Australian Story about a man called John Button who was accused of killing his girlfriend. And I think the grieving parents in that situation have taken a long time since finally he was released from prison and his conviction was quashed, taken a long time ever to accept that he wasn't the guilty party. In this situation, I watched the father go from being a grieving parent to a grieving parent with a role in the criminal proceeding and then to a grieving parent who was going by hook or crook to prove that his son did nothing to provoke this and that the young man who so willfully and brutally slaughtered his son was not just a murderer but was a sociopath who should never, and that's what they called for, never be released from prison, that he should die in prison, that he should be buried in the same way that his son was buried, but buried alive. Now, I could understand that, Paul. Heinous as it is, I felt in my bones probably that if I was in that situation, I would hate. I'd be a hater. I'd be like a Collingwood supporter. I'd be a hater, an absolute unrelenting hater. However, it's up to a court system or a justice system to take hold of that hate and put it to one side. It's a human instinct to hate, but it has no part in a court case.
You can't help but get the impression, and I make no allegation of corruption here, but you cannot but get the impression that not only was Jock in the wrong place at the wrong time, but he killed the wrong person from the wrong family.
You can make all sorts of assumptions like that. You can certainly paint a picture of that kind.
I don't expect you to answer that.
I think all sorts of things. I mean, it's a complex situation. Jock always said he doesn't remember knifing anybody.
Yeah, that's right, he does.
And I thought, oh, yeah, sure. I'm perfectly positive that a great many people who have killed somebody with a knife say, I don't remember, I won't blank, I don't remember it happening. A great many people who've killed people full stop possibly argue they don't remember it happening. And I never really believed him until I saw this CCTV footage and what never came out in the court proceedings and what the defence never saw, because they were given a minuscule access to that CCTV footage in a situation where the parents of the dead young man were standing shoulder to shoulder with the defendant and the father of the defendant so that they could all hear each other's heartbeats. And the defendant, Jock, and his father are watching to find what happened. And the parents of the dead boy are seeing the last moments of their son alive and seeing the son being carted off with his leg and arm hanging off the stretcher and being put into the ambulance. A more horrific situation you can't imagine. That was the defence access to that CCTV footage.
And they saw it once on a small screen?
They saw it twice on a portable computer, a PC, on a tiny screen. When I got access to it, I spent days watching it with my researcher. And we watched it over and over and over again, freezing frames, stopping, going back, looking at it again, timing everything out. What never came out in even the Bulgarian expert report on the CCTV footage was that in one of these swirling events where Jock is surrounded by a group of people who are clearly bending down onto the ground, picking things up, and there's all these broken bits of concrete tiles all around the square, many parts of Bulgarian footpaths, as many parts of old Europe has broken bits of concrete tiling and pavers. They're bending down and they're throwing things. They said it was little bits of dirt and pebbles, but it's far more likely it was these broken bits of concrete pavers. They're bending and throwing things at him. They're surrounding him. He's spinning around like in a circle. You can't see the knife in his hand, but he's got an arm outstretched. So presumably he's trying to create a field around him of safety. And then at one point, one of the things that are being thrown clearly hits him in the head. Bang! Down he goes on the ground. And he remembers thinking he was going to die at that point, but doesn't remember what happened next. What happened next was he got up and the swirling around him continues and he seems to move in towards them, and then they're surrounding him and then he bolts away from them. Now, that's a very critical part for the defence. Well, the defence never raised it because he doesn't remember it. This is going to the question of, was he honest, was he truthful in saying he doesn't remember stabbing anyone?
Now, you're being very careful about not divulging your own views. Fair enough. And we should resist always being arrogant about our own legal system in comparison with others. I accept that. But you can't tell me that after a year of looking into this case, you don't have some views as to whether or not you accept Jock's essential argument that he was acting in self-defence. At the end of the day, and I'm not even really talking here about a legally acceptable definition of self-defence, do you think that he was a young man who basically was trying to protect himself and inadvertently did something terrible to somebody?
From the moment when Jock was surrounded by young men who were clearly throwing things at him, bending down, throwing, running back to get something else, running forwards, throwing, and then hit him in the head, and then he tried to escape and they chased after him, once I saw that, I thought, at least at that moment, Jock would have feared for his life. He would have been, even though he's a big fellow, was a rower, rugby player, he would have been fearful for his life, and his brain would have just gone, it would have crashed at that point. I have no doubt now that he feared for his life. The young men all argued in court that they feared for their life, and I can see that the sight of a knife and someone moving towards you with a knife, although certainly the young men were walking away from him at some points with seemingly, you know, unperturbed. They weren't running away from him. But nonetheless, I can see that at some points in that whole melee over 5 minutes, they will have been fearful too. They're all full of alcohol, I would presume. But I have no doubt that certainly from the time he was hit in the head, and he doesn't recall anything, he would have been terrified. He would have been acting in self-defence. Now, if we are being a judge and jury, should he have taken a knife out? Should he have moved forwards to try to, as he says, move them away from the gypsy on the ground? Should he have done that? Should he have ever intervened? We can, you know, we can speculate on all of those things. That question of should he have intervened in the first place?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, isn't it?
That is one that I've mulled over and mulled
over. What is the right thing to do in a situation like that?
Of course, we have to assume, we have to take his word for it, that he was intervening, because the young men in the court say, ultimately they said there was no altercation, he had no reason to intervene, nobody, as the judges wrote, nobody needed his assistance. So if we assume that he was going to the assistance of somebody, yes, I've asked myself over and over, would I want a child going to the assistance of someone? Would I go to the assistance of someone? As I was writing this book, I had a visceral experience of the situation in a smaller degree that Jock, I suppose, saw. My daughter had just finished school. She was 18. She's a tall, beautiful, of course, young woman dripping in Mimco and, you know, out with a girlfriend in a very fashionable part of Melbourne, De Grave Street, having coffee outside. Coffee, people, tables and people drinking coffee everywhere. Very Melbourne, quintessential Melbourne. No doubt they were all dressed in black. Anyway, people all over the place. And my daughter and her friend were sitting at a table. They had their probably Mimco purses and their sunglasses and their mobile phones on the table. And an older woman approached them and grabbed some of their belongings. And my daughter immediately went to grab it back, and the woman said, you know, swore at them. And then I think either my daughter or her friend swore back. Then certainly her friend started to scream, and then the woman pulled up her sleeve and showed a loaded syringe, a red loaded syringe, and said, you know, swearing again. And my daughter grabbed this woman's other hand and foolishly, I think, and probably she would too, grabbed her things from the woman. And at that point, this woman said, "You are raving idiots," not using those words, using far more colourful ones, and disappeared. Now, the thing is that all that time, they were both screaming, and my daughter's friend was banging on the shoulder of coffee drinkers sitting less than a metre away from them. "Help, help, help." Not a soul even turned around. Not a soul assisted them. After it happened and police came, the waiter and some of the coffee drinkers were apologetic, but the instinct of the wait staff and the coffee drinkers there was to turn away from the conflict, not to help. Now, how do I feel about that? I am absolutely livid. And that's a terrible situation that we have if we are all so fearful or so self-absorbed that we don't even say, "Hey, you," to try to assist a young person screaming out for help.
Look, before we come to the verdict and the wrap-up and sort of where to now, one thing we should remind all of ourselves about is that there is a tragedy at the centre of this book, and it's to your great credit that the tragedy never goes away throughout the book, in spite of the fact that an Australian is rotting in a Bulgarian jail, and we may, many of us, feel sympathy for his plight. You know, the presence of this young, dead Bulgarian permeates the book, and there is a moment when you get to talk, to interview his mother. Tell us about that, how you felt that moment. I think you only had one interview with her, is that right?
I would hardly call it an interview. We had arranged to meet, and it was going to be something like an interview. I was in the courthouse, and my Boriana, the researcher, and I had been reviewing the files. She wanted access to the files, so I think she was probably annoyed that a journalist, particularly an Australian journalist, was going through the file at that moment. So I was there and I was looking through some things before our designated meeting time. We weren't going to be meeting in that particular room, by the way. Anyway, my researcher had just stepped out for that moment, and in came Andre Monoff's mother, who's a lawyer, distressed looking. I knew her from sitting in on hearings, and she, you know, walked up to me, started speaking in Bulgarian, so of course I didn't understand because Boriana wasn't there. Then she went to the file, and I thought, I know what she's going to point to. I know what she's going to point to. And she flipped through some pages and her finger went down and it was exactly what I expected. And I burst into tears. It was the autopsy pictures. Mm. There's her beautiful son on a plank with his face, you know, bruised from having fallen to the ground, and another shot of his heart all opened up. She was in tears. I was in tears. The library staff woman who was following along behind her was also in tears. Boriana came back in and so started to translate for me. But she wasn't going to linger very long and just shouted at me, you know, how can he, this Australian, how can he have done this? And how can this particular human rights fellow, who's a character in the book, how can he argue that Jock has been hardly done by, you know, what, it doesn't a person have the right to their life? Mm. Her pain was understandable, was, you know, coming from her gut, and was upsetting for me and for all those who saw it. So, yes, I understand. They will hurt forever.
Okay, we're almost at the end. We should say, Jock, of course, as we all know, is found guilty. All of the appeal processes, most of the appeal processes have been exhausted. What is his sentence? Can you remind us?
He was sentenced to 20 years. So the family of the dead young man are furious because they wanted life without parole. The prosecution wanted life. The court decided that Jock had no priors, that he could be reformed, and that 20 years would be enough time, just enough time to rehabilitate him.
Is 20 years 20 years in Bulgaria?
No, 20 years comes with the prospect of parole about halfway through, but there is a long tradition, in Sofia Central Prison at least, of not granting parole.
So where to now for Jock and for Simon, who we haven't mentioned a great deal, but his dad has been a dogged supporter, and at great personal expense, at great expense, one gets the feeling to his own health and well-being, actually, too, in supporting his son. Where do they go now with this case?
The Polfremans now accept that the Bulgarian courts have made their decision, and they want Jock transferred to an Australian prison, probably one in New South Wales, because that's where his family is from. And Bulgaria and Australia, unlike, for example, Australia and Indonesia, Bulgaria and Australia are both signatories to an international agreement, an international prisoner transfer agreement. So there is the mechanism there to enable such a transfer to take place. For example, in the case of Chappelle Corby and others incarcerated in Indonesia, it's a different situation. Indonesia is not a signatory to this agreement. But in this case, both countries are signatories, so it could take place. It could be a fairly straightforward matter, but it's not. And thus far, it hasn't been.
Belinda Hawkins, who I spoke with at Avid Reader in Brisbane earlier this year. Every Parent's Nightmare is published by Allen and Unwin. In it, you'll find much more detail of the court case, the contested evidence, and other aspects crucial to the trial and the verdict. There's also some more information available on our website.